Today I'm going to talk about physician complicity in human rights abuses and present data from a study that was conducted by myself and others from PHR in Iraq in 2003. So worldwide, physicians or other medical personnel participate in up to 50% of torture sessions. And medical complicity has in human rights abuses has been documented in many countries, including countries such as Nazi Germany or Chile that were dictatorships, as well as in those that are democracies, such as the U.S. or Israel. And this issue is particular salience now in light of evidence that U.S. medical personnel, physicians and psychologists and others, participated in human rights abuses in Guantanamo Bay and perhaps elsewhere. Also, this is a specific case of a dual loyalty conflict, that is, a conflict in which a physician has loyalty both to the patient, where the physician's medical oath is to work for the good of the patient, as well as to a second party, whether that's the state, an insurer, or an employer. Now, Iraq was an interesting place in which to conduct this study, in part because it was known that medical personnel had participated in grave violations of human rights. So in the mid-90s, there was an ear-cutting edict, and ear-cutting was promulgated as punishment for a variety of offenses. But what was particularly egregious about this was that in the edict, it specified that physicians were to cut ears, and that this was done to be done in civilian rather than military hospitals. Also, study of psychological coping mechanisms of physicians faced with this particular dual loyalty conflict can be brought to bear on other situations of dual loyalty. So, for instance, where physicians may be dealing with loyalties to insurers or employers. And finally, examination of the structural enabling factors that allow for gross contravention of medical ethics and human rights may help physicians in the future to build institutions and strategies to resist medical involvement in human rights abuses. So the goals of this particular study were first to characterize the nature of physician participation in human rights abuses in Ba'athist Iraq and from 88 to 2003. Second, to explore the cognitive and psychological mechanisms that physicians use to justify their participation in human rights abuses. And third, to assess approaches for prevention of future physician participation in abuses. And today I'm going to be focusing on the second goal. So we conducted the study over a three-week period in southern Iraq in the summer of 2003, and this was a mixed methods study. It included both a self-administered survey of 98 physicians who were practicing in three major civilian hospitals, which had general surgical units, and also semi-structured interviews with three hospital directors and approximately 60 practicing physicians. Now, to orient you a little bit here, this is Baghdad. The study we conducted was here in Najaf and Dikar governorates in the south, which together covered a population of about 2.4 million people. Also, by way of background, the south of Iraq is predominantly Shia, and Najaf and Nasiriyah were two cities in which the population participated quite a bit in the 91 uprising against Saddam Hussein, which was crushed. And in particular, there was were several incidents, including one in 91, where the Iraqi army went through a hospital in Najaf and summarily executed patients that had any wounds that they thought could have been sustained by fighters, and then buried these people in mass graves. So we recruited physicians from doctors, lounges, and hospitals, and by snowball sampling, which in practice meant walking down this street, which is where all the doctor's offices were, and speaking to the first physician and saying, oh, by the way, can you introduce me to your friends? And we got data from semi-structured interviews, group interviews, as well as free text responses on the anonymous surveys. Two interviews were taped and transcribed in their entirety, and the others were reconstructed from written notes each day. There was an interpreter present at the so that if our physicians wanted to use the interpreter, they could. And then our transcripts were coded for themes. So several themes emerged from our qualitative analysis. First, discussion of the types of abuses perpetrated. Second, the cognitive and psychological mechanisms that were employed by physicians to reconcile upholding their ethical principles with, on the other hand, having participated in grave human rights abuses against their patients. Third, mechanisms to prevent future abuses. And the fourth was many talked about physicians both being abusers as well as being victims. So this I'll go over relatively quickly. So the types of abuses that physicians were forced to perpetrate that emerged in qualitative analysis were similar to those that emerged from quantitative analysis on the survey. So this included ear cutting, which had been well documented, falsification of death certificates, harvesting of organs without patients' or family members' permission, non-therapeutic use of drugs and medical devices, patching up detainees so torture could continue, supervising and participating in execution, and remaining silent in the face of abuses. I'm going to present just a few quotes that illustrate some of these. So in ear cutting, a physician said, "The leadership of the country regarded the ear cutting as a political test. Either you like the country or not. You have to perform this type of surgery or you are not on the side of the government. It was an order from the leadership, the holy leadership." A surgeon who, during his military service, had performed it as a doctor, related that he was a general medical anesthesiologist from 84 to 88 in the military. The army captured a soldier from the other side, and they asked me to give him light anesthesia in order that they could question him. My colleague, a military doctor, administered anesthesia. And this, on patching up prisoners so torture could continue. A physician related, "The security man came, shouting, and ordered the doctor," and this is in a public hospital, "to see the detainees. Come see this patient and do whatever you like to him, and then let us go back. It is an embarrassing situation for any doctor. He knows that this patient has to be admitted to have proper medical care, but he can't admit him, and he can't even say the patient needs to be admitted. So he has to give them any medication that is available and let them go. And probably it is better for them to die." And finally, remaining silent in the face of abuses. And many physicians talked about particular things such as wounds, skin contractures, trauma from handcuffs or other sorts of ligatures. I'd like to focus the main part of this talk on the psychological mechanisms that were employed by physicians to justify participation in abuses. And these included denial, bureaucratization of the physician's role, dehumanization of victims, identification with the government, displacement of responsibility, lesser evil rationalization, and finally stating the obvious, which is that they were, in many cases, coerced and didn't participate willingly. So this is a urologist who, when asked about examining patients who may have suffered urologic trauma who have been sent from prison, said, "Some patients said that they had, that security had," and then he stopped. And when he was questioned particularly about whether any patients with blood in their urine, for instance, might have had blunt trauma, that is being struck in their flank over their kidney, he said, "Patients malinger. At that time, I only did my job. I didn't ask the cause of trauma to protect myself. The military hospital saw most of these cases of urological trauma, peritoneal tears, all sorts of urological injuries. We didn't see them here." Dehumanization of victims. This from a physician who used to work in a military hospital, who started out by saying, "I did not see many prisoners who had been tortured. Some of the prisoners had homosexual relations with each other. When I examined some prisoners in the security office, some of them were smugglers, and some were those who had falsified official documents." And then he ends by saying, "As for me, I never saw prisoners who had been tortured." So over one paragraph, he goes from saying he didn't see many prisoners who he didn't, to he never saw prisoners who had been tortured. Identification with the government. So some physicians said that the government needed to make special rules because of special circumstances. Displacement of responsibility. This was from a hospital director who was director of the hospital during the period of time when ear cutting was performed in his hospital. And he said, "There were two who were culpable. First, Saddam Hussein for the edict. And two, his security men, because they took his orders and didn't carry them out in a simple way. They did so in a severe way." And what's missing here is any statement of responsibility for physicians or even a statement of contrition. Next is a lesser evil justification or rationalization. So one surgeon, speaking again of ear cutting, said, They brought in the patients in front of everyone in the lobby and announced, "These men are here for the cutting of their ears." Everyone was crying out. The women there were wailing. I said, "No, this is shameful. Put these men in a room separate from the lobby," and I had them moved. I refused the way in which they were doing it, displaying the patient in public. I couldn't refuse the decision. It came from Saddam Hussein. But I refused the way it was being done in public. And in fact, there were people who had refused. There were people who had fled Iraq, and there were people who had lost their lives because of their public refusal. And then finally, coercion. And what was curious in conducting the study was that there weren't more physicians who simply said, "Well, look, I didn't do this because I wanted to. I did this because I was forced." But among the few who did talk about being forced, this one surgeon said, "The doctors had no choice. We were threatened with execution for refusing to comply with security officers' orders. You don't know what it was like in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. They would kill you and your family. I definitely feared they would harm me or my family if I refused." Now, the next theme that emerged was mechanisms to prevent future abuses. And I list these here in a single slide, in part because often when physicians would bring these up, they would give a one-word or a one-sentence answer and kind of stop there. So among those were freedom, democracy, ethics courses, higher salaries, honest government, dismantling of the security apparatus of the state, participation of doctors in government, in elected government, and finally independence of the Iraqi Medical Association from the government. And the final theme I'll talk about is physicians as both abusers and victims. These are quotes from two different surgeons in southern Iraq. One said, "Non-therapeutic amputation, that is ear cutting, was a big trauma to all the doctors. I'm sure some of them could not eat after doing it, because they felt it was not our job, and we should be saving the life of the patient and not crippling him. These doctors feel ashamed. Some became frightened. They felt they were wanted by the family of the patient." And another said, comparing this both to a military attack as well as to medical illness, said, "It was a disaster, like a chemical weapons attack or an epidemic. It came in like a stroke. At first you thought they were just talking, making a joke, but you know it is no joke. You cannot feel at all." Now, one form of torture for those in the room who aren't familiar with different types of torture can be being forced to perpetrate torture against someone else. And it could be considered that some of these physicians were themselves thus tortured by being forced to harm their patients. Undoubtedly, there were those who participated willingly as well. But it was a very complex situation. Finally, there are several limitations to our study. First, generalizability. We conducted this study during one particular time in one particular place, in fact, in one particular region of a country. The next is response bias. So, as I alluded to before, physicians who had most actively resisted had lost their jobs, they had fled, or they had been killed. It's possible that physicians who were complicit either were non-responders or may not have been entirely truthful. Our study was conducted in an unstable political situation in which mechanisms of accountability for past abuses hadn't been established, and I think that may have created a powerful incentive for people not to talk openly about what they themselves had done, but rather to talk obliquely. And finally, a collection of data was time-limited, so instead of, say, continuing data collection until we had reached saturation of themes, we had a set period of time that we were in the field collecting data. So in summary, we found that physician participation in human rights abuses in Iraq was a significant problem. We found that physicians in Iraq used many similar psychological and cognitive mechanisms to justify their participation as had physicians in other situations, in particular in Nazi Germany, where it's been well studied and documented. And finally, this was a very complex situation because some physicians who were coerced to abuse patients may themselves be victims of abuse. So first off, this suggests universality of doctors, or more generally, a healthcare worker's mechanisms to reconcile dual loyalty conflicts. The second thing that stood out was that medical ethics training alone is insufficient to prevent abuses. So most of these physicians said that they had been through medical ethics training and they could, say, well, the basic one of the basic responsibilities a doctor has is to work for the good of his or her patients. But structural factors can make it impossible for medical personnel to uphold these ethical principles. And importantly, some of the same issues pertain to participation of U.S. physicians and psychologists in interrogation and torture in the war on terror in Guantanamo and other places. So a multi-level approach to preventing medical participation in human rights abuses is necessary. So education and training form the basis of this. But beyond that, there needs to be transparency and oversight of medical practice in situations that are most likely to be sites of abuse. So these include closed institutions, prisons, and detention facilities. Next, independence of physician practice and physician organizations from the state. And finally, professional organizations have a role first in having policies against member participation in abuses. But beyond that, supporting physicians who bring abuses to light and also using their collective voice to press for respect for human rights. And I'd like to close with two final quotes. This is from a victim of ear cutting, and he said, "I think that the doctor should have refused to do the operation. I heard that some of them refused, some ran away, and some were executed. If all doctors refused to make such operations, Saddam could not have executed all doctors." And he really spoke very eloquently to, you know, the power of collective action. And finally, this from an internist who was somewhat angry when we first met him, and said, "You know, Dr. Amina, what would you have done if you were in the position of these doctors who cut ears? What would you have done if you knew that if you refused, your ear would be cut or you or your family might be killed? Tell me honestly, what would you do?" I asked this question to the other American doctor who was here, and you know what he told me? He told me, "My government would never ask me to do such a thing." So, on that note, here are some sources for further information. Thanks very much.